Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Read. This is the first conversation in our series about Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake. So there are four episodes in this series, and we really hope you enjoy them. So the first one is with Danil McLaughlin. He's a novelist from Wellington, and Atwood has described Oryx and Crake as speculative fiction and adventure romance rather than science fiction, because it does not deal with things we can't yet do or begin to do, and goes beyond the realism she associates with the novel form. So Danil and I take on the contentious idea that Oryx and Crake is actually a science fiction novel. And we sort of look at this, we look at it as a science fiction novel, and we also look at how the genetic engineering fear that is sort of embedded in that book sort of looks 14 years later. So Danil and I end up talking about a lot of books, and I've put a list of these on the WordPress page for you to have a look at. So that's betterreadnz.wordpress.com. So betterreadnz.wordpress.com. So there's one issue with the recording in here, and I think it's going to be a huge issue. I haven't actually listened back, but I'm very worried about it. There was a lot of cell phone noise, that sort of weird, wah-wah that can sometimes go through when cell phones are happening. So after Danil and I checked both our phones, we realised that the interference was actually coming from people walking past the building. And although it's annoying, I thought that was quite interesting, you know, that we live in this world where there's all this sort of electronic action going on and we don't often feel it going through ourselves, but you can hear it going through this recording. So yeah, I hope you really enjoy this episode. I love talking to Danil. I always come across, just anytime I come away from a conversation with Danil, I just want to sort of close all my doors and read for the next 10 years. So yes, thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy this.
Snowman wakes before dawn. He lies unmoving, listening to the tide coming in, wave after wave sloshing over the various barricades, wish-wash, wish-wash, the rhythm of heartbeat. He would so like to believe he is still asleep. On the eastern horizon there's a greyish haze, lit now with a rosy, deadly glow. Strange how that colour still seems tender. The offshore towers stand out in dark silhouette against it, rising improbably out of the pink and pale blue of the lagoon. The shrieks of the birds that nest out there, and the distant ocean grinding against the ersatz reefs of rusted car parts and jumbled bricks and assorted rubble, sound almost like holiday traffic. Out of habit, he looks at his watch. Stainless steel case, burnished aluminium brand, still shiny, although it no longer works. He wears it now as his only talisman. A blank face is what it shows him, 0 hour. It causes a jolt of terror to run through him, this absence of official time. Nobody, nowhere, knows what time it is.
Hello, Danil.
Hello, Pip.
How are you?
I'm good.
That's very good. Very okay. Good. So we are here today to talk about Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. And I'm very excited because I think when I spoke to you on email, we decided that what we would quite like to talk about today is this book as a science fiction novel.
Yeah.
And I guess, with that in mind, my first question to you would be, is this a science fiction novel?
It is. I really think it is. If it wasn't published by a literary novelist, it would just go on the science fiction shelves. And something you quite often see with literary novelists when they do publish science fiction is that they say something like what Atwood has said, which is that no, it's not science fiction, it's speculative fiction, I think is her line. Completely different. And I think that they say that for marketing reasons, that they know that their readers are less likely to go and buy a book if it's in that different section of the bookstore. And I think that's fine, you know, that she's a professional novelist and she's, you know, this is her job and she has to do what works for her. But I don't think anyone else needs to kind of buy into the marketing department line that it's not, you know, it's not science fiction when she's just doing what lots and lots of other people, in this book at least, are doing in that genre.
And just with that in mind, does it stand up to the rigors of science fiction? Like, what elements of it are science fiction? Like, what What makes it science fiction? There we go. I'm asking you to define an entire genre.
What is science fiction? I wish I'd thought of a really good answer to that, because now I'll just have to fumble around. I guess science fiction is about asking what if and imagining one of the cliches about science fiction is that science fiction writers are really writing about present day and then speculating out about current trends, and sometimes it's technological trends and other times it's not. Taking things to their logical extreme and saying this is where we're heading, or commenting on society.
Mm.
That's something that there have been a few novels in recent years, and one of them is Red Plenty, which is by Francis Buford, which is a great book. And it's actually set in the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s. And just because of the way... it really feels like a science fiction novel when you're reading it.
Mm.
And so that really challenges that traditional thing that it's projecting current trends into the future. It's actually looking at a completely different society and economic system. Shaman by Kim Stanley Robinson, who is famous hard sci-fi author, which is actually set in the Paleolithic era, but is still on the science fiction shelves. And, you know, he is a science fiction writer, again, that stands outside that traditional classification. So I don't know how to define it.
Yeah.
You know, there's that famous quote from a US Supreme Court justice, "I don't know what pornography is, I just know it when I see it." And that's the same with me for science fiction.
Yeah.
I mostly know when I see it, and this, you know, I'm seeing it now in Hawks and Crake. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering, with that idea of sort of projecting science out, I was wondering, this book was written at a certain time.
Yep.
And we are in a certain time.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, is there a risk with a book like this? I'm thinking of more kind of big space opera kind of stuff, which feels like it dates, but in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
Is there this...
How is it dated?
Yeah, how is it dated?
I think that it is very much of its time. It was published in, I think, 2004.
Yeah,
Let me just go and double check that thing. 2003. And that was at a time where there really was a lot of interest and also a lot of public hysteria about genetic technologies and genetic engineering. The human genome had been sequenced and a sheep had been cloned, and lots of public intellectuals were talking about this dark, this, how we're on the cusp of just this radical technological change, that it was going to be like the IT revolution but in a biological sense, and that it could transform our planet very, very quickly. And, you know, Atwood is really writing about, and lots of other people were writing books about that kind of thing at the time, and Atwood's written this book. And so we're, I don't know, 14 years later, the technology hasn't advanced nearly as quickly as anybody thought it would. And that's just because people thought it was going to be analogous to the IT revolution.
Mm.
And biological systems are just so much more complex than software engineered systems. The level of complexity to do the things that Atwood's writing about in this book are just still literally decades away. So people who like to be afraid of technology aren't really even that afraid of GE technology anymore. The thing people are afraid of AI and the technological singularity, and so that's kind of what's fashionable to be a doomsayer about at the moment. So
that fear really comes in cycles, I was just thinking about you know, the science fiction that I can sort of touch my hand on just sitting here thinking about it, you know, like you can almost, and I guess that's sort of a bit of a cliche, but it says so much more about the time and the fears of the time.
Totally.
Because that is something that the technology in here, the genetic technology in here, and Oryx and Crake, it just seems like they're just dialing it up. You know, it's like, oh, I'll have a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of that.
Absolutely.
And I must admit that when GE, you know, especially food crops and that sort of thing came in, that's honestly what I thought it was going to be like. We were just going to splice bits in before we knew it, you know, But I just think this still, and what in some ways this has kind of worked for her, because that dystopia or that apocalypse still seems in the future, you know what I mean? Like it's still, the stuff with the, particularly the chickens that are growing with business, that kind of, that feels like we could still be heading that way.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think But I don't think that's all necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there's one very famous genetically engineered food called golden rice, which is basically just rice that has been engineered so that it produces beta carotene, which is a precursor for vitamin A. And about 500,000 children die every year because of vitamin A deficiency. But it's there's intense resistance to making that publicly available because of fear of genetically engineered technologies and how it could lead to a slippery slope or something. And you know, when you're dealing with 500,000 children under 5 dying every year, it's, I don't know, I don't think a slippery slope argument is very credible. And you know, so in that sense, I think the fear of the technology has been mostly a bad thing. And a lot of the some GE technology is less about, I don't know, chickens or pigs as happening on the bacterial level, because bacteria are much easier to work with yeast, and they're about things like trying to grow ethical meat. So absolutely. So yeah, and that would be a great thing, and something I often wonder about, because I'm a member of the Green Party and it has this stand on genetic engineering, is what happens if sooner or later someone invents some kind of plant which is a super carbon sequestering, which would solve global warming, and that would be a really interesting and probably quite divisive debate within the party about whether you're going to improve that level of technology.
Because that is one of the things about this book, is that the big bad is quite, oh, is this mean to say? I might be misrepresenting it, but it is quite a simple idea.
Yeah.
You know, like it is quite a simple rendering of, because that's the thing. I know once I started looking into genetics, you know, just simply, you know, because I thought there's a gene that tells you whether you're going to get breast cancer.
Yeah.
But what there actually is there's a pattern of genes that sometimes happen, and statistically and all that sort of thing. And I was just thinking how this does tend, you know, the big bad seems just simplistically bad. Like there's from memory, I can't think of a the first, the pigs are invented to solve this problem, but it isn't, there doesn't ever seem to be a moment where there is a golden rice moment. Doesn't seem to be that.
Yeah, and that's part of what Atwood's saying in the book, because it's all, none of what the genetic scientists are doing in her book really have any value outside of consumerism, and her book is a critique of a consumerist society. So it's all about, you know, trying to bring new products to market and cost efficiency. Whereas, and obviously that stuff happens in the biotechnology industry, but golden rice was one of the first things that people looked at, ethical foods, and so I kind of think that when you're writing a satire, and it is a satire, it's okay to be hyperbolic and overblown, but I don't know if that was really that effective in this book. Some of the things that people produce in the book are just kind of, I think, stupid. And I'm not normally a nerd about this sort of stuff. I don't mind because it's not hard science fiction, if a writer isn't being really loyal to the science. But one of the organisms is something called, I think it's a snat or a snape, which is a rat crossed by a snake. And it would be really hard to cross a mammal with a reptile like that. You're talking probably tens of billions of dollars for something which basically serves no purpose. And it just kind of seems, it feels like she was just sort of sitting at her typewriter thinking of two animals which people don't like, and then she just sort of, I don't know, it felt like a bit of a failure of imagination.
So, like this distinction you're making sort of between hard science fiction and I don't know what the opposite is, but I often think how there is, you know, like I think in the science fiction that I'm thinking of, and I haven't read heaps, but I do love it, and I've read quite a lot, there does seem to be this break between an investigation of what our minds will be like when that happens, and an investigation of sort of what the science will look like when that happens. And one of the things I'm really interested in this book is the idea that a lot of the characters feel they got hit, and I guess this is a structural thing that you have to do, but maybe it's a plot thing. They were hit at a time where the apocalypse kind of happened. So psychologically, you're bringing pre-apocalyptic people into the apocalypse.
Yeah.
And I just, I don't know, like, I'm always interested in that idea where if a society is a certain way, surely our psychology would be so different.
Yeah.
But yeah, do you feel, and it is told sort of from first person, and then there are kind of these interesting, you know, like the device is quite interesting.
Yeah.
We hit Snowman when he is Snowman
and
you know, in the future, and then he's sort of haunted by these memories and is piecing together his story.
Yeah.
What did you think of that, you know, that sort of, did you find that convincing?
It's a good, I mean, it's a really good structure for these post-apocalyptic stories. You can use lots and lots of times where the kind of the reveal, the sort of mystery is how the apocalypse happened, and you gradually reveal that the story of the person that you're hearing about in the future was pivotal and what, how it all came about. And actually, one of the classic examples of that is that movie La Jetée that we talked about last so it's the exact same device, you know, and again an apocalyptic story, and again a plague that wipes out all of humanity. So I'm just trying to remember the rest of your question.
It just occurred to me today, you know, like, because I sort of, one of my favourite books is Ridley Walker, and I think that through language that sort of creates a different idea of psychology. And I was just thinking that, it just occurred to me when I was thinking about this book today that, you know, that is a really good strategy, because I'm thinking that a person 100 years into this apocalypse will be thinking so differently, I won't recognise their language. And so I was just thinking that it is a really interesting plot that you find people that are at this sort of nexus. Whereas I was thinking some of the bigger kind of, I don't know, like I keep thinking about the Philip K. Dick book. Oh, is it even Philip K. Dick? The book, oh, maybe it's Philip Roth, the one that's mentioned in the James Gleick book about the multi-dimensions and stuff like that, which just seems so far away from our reality. Right. But this does sit quite closely to our reality, doesn't it?
I think so. I just kind of want to go answer your question by going off on a tangent a little bit, because you mentioned quite a few post-apocalyptic works there, and there's something which I think Orcs and Crake really connects to the strand of the apocalyptic tradition in Western literature, and there's this great book of literary criticism, I don't know if you've read it, called The Sense of an Ending by Frank Kermode, and he's basically writing about like this exact subject, these kind of books. And his theory is that humans have this real, especially as we get older, have this real difficulty, well, some of us at least, coming to grips with the idea that we're going to die and that our lives are very, very brief, and that they don't take place in a very meaningful time in history, that we're not that special. And so we have this concept of the apocalypse we've latched onto, which is to say actually our lives are special because we're living at the end of history. It's not going to go on. It's all going to come to an end. And the temptation is for, and obviously you can see that in the Christian literary tradition and lots of other writers writing in that, people saying, well, all the things that I don't like about the world are the reason that it's going to come to an end, so there's going to be this, you know, punishment. And really that's exactly what Atwood is saying here. She's saying all this consumerism and scientific hubris and men exploiting people sexually, it's going to destroy the world, and it, you know, so that's kind of what her book is about. I think
I really like that idea, and like that idea of, I keep thinking about, is that called eschatology?
Eschatology is the end of the world.
And I was just thinking about, because we had a little talk, well, it was just a little comment you made, and I kept thinking about Infinite Jest when I was reading this book, and I kept thinking about, for lots of reasons, but that game, you know, the game that takes place. But you were saying that you think there are similarities possibly between...
Yeah, I think so. I guess I should admit that I didn't really like this book that much. And I thought, because I'd never read any Atwood novel other than A Handmaid's Tale. And I kind of thought that it was going to be sort of operating at that level, that I was about to read something that it was unlike anything else I'd ever read. And Orcs and Crake is just like a lot of books that I've read before. And so Infinite Jest is, you know, set in the near future, and there's the environmental destruction, the Great Concavity, and it's all about it's a satire of rampant consumerism in which, you know, like the years are named, you know, corporations bid to be able to name the year. So the year that it's set is the year of the deep end adult undergarment. And that's really what the near future in Orcs and Crake is, that exact, is just hitting that exact same tone and making the same jokes. And the other thing she does is, and I think Ballard was a huge influence on this book, his also writing in a dystopian near now, also satirizing late capitalism and consumerism. And she, Ballard writes in that, I don't know what to call it, the flattened effect, which is when it's very, he's writing about really shocking things, as Atwood does in this book, but he's writing it with a very, very detached, ironic tone. And it, yeah, it has this quite powerful effect, but and that was diminished for me in Orcs and Crake, because it just seemed like an imitation of another very, very famous writer.
Because that was the thing that I kept slipping into when I was, like, maybe, like, everyone knows how much I like Infinite Jest, and I'm just a bit ridiculous about it, but, like, I did find myself thinking about Howling Condens, you know, like...
Yeah.
Snowman in a way feels like a character I've met before, and I think that that was really interesting about it for me, you know, like there did seem to be this sort of and Drowned World, like I kept thinking about that because that book was such a had such an effect on me last year when I read it, like the idea that we're not gonna freeze to death and we're not going to burn to death in a clean burning, we're going to kind of swelter and just stew to death. And I thought that that captured that in there as well. And it is really interesting because I guess, oh man, I just so love that theory. Because I think that...
But one of the things I quite like about The Drowned World, which is Ballard's book, which is set in the near future when the sea levels have risen, is that it doesn't buy into the moralistic post-apocalyptic thing. There's no reason. It's not because we've all kind of been sexist or bought too much stuff. It's just a thing that's happened. The sun cycles have changed. And so, I like it that he's... just not bought into that.
Because I guess that's another option, isn't it? Is that you forget about the why and you just get into the what the fuck are we going to do? Which I think is so appealing about Drowned World, is that you've got this really odd, you know, like everybody trying to live, you know, and you know, that wonderful, oh my God, the beautiful end to it, you know. And I think that it is a different way, eh? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, The Road, the McCarthy book, which is another post-apocalyptic book, it opts out of that as well. There's no discussion of how it all ended. There's just this one line, there was a long shear of light and then a series of low concussions, and that's all he says, and the rest of it is just how it plays out.
Whereas in a book like this, as you say, the whole plot device is finding out how the apocalypse happened, and you know, luckily we're with someone who, well, obviously because it was because engineered so that he could survive. It's quite interesting. One thing that I did think was that did strike me as quite I thought the beings that had been you know, the children of Crake, that's what they're called, the humanoid type people, I thought they felt relatively original, but is that just because I haven't read far enough?
I don't know. Well, I thought a couple of things. One thing you mentioned is that you wanted to talk to me about Philip K. Dick.
Yes, and let's talk about that.
Yeah, because the children of, because I think there are similarities again between this book and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is yet another, and what this is something I love about Philip K. Dick, is that is a post-apocalyptic novel. All the animals are dead because of radiation wars, and but society isn't radically different. It's just kind of like it is now, except it's sort of a little bit crappier, and which is, something I really like. And so you have the replicants or the androids or whatever, and which are... because in this book they're sort of better than in Orcs and Crake, they are an improvement on humanity, but in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the book is a bit ambivalent, but Dick is quite afraid of them because he's religious and he thinks that they would have no soul, they would have no empathy, and so and that's a very frightening thing for him. So that was something that I thought was interesting, and the difference between them. There's also, I'm just referencing book after book here.
That's great. We can make a wee bibliography at the end.
is that one of Michelle Olubeck's earlier books, The Elementary Particles, mm-hmm. which that's also I think published in the US as Atomized, is again incredibly similar to Orcs and Crake, and there's a geneticist, a biologist, who just decides that humanity is too flawed, and so he's going to invent again that, you know, it's our sexuality that is the root of our evil, and so he invents a new race, and so that doesn't have all those kind of all of those terrible flaws which are going to destroying the earth.
Mm.
So yeah, the children of Crake kind of speak to both of those things, I think.
And there's such a weird again, it's got that kind of wizardry around it about, yeah. we'll make them like this. Yeah, no, we'll put some of this exactly, in. We've got another excuse to get her, the fetishized woman naked into it is a really interesting, I really enjoyed them when they came along. And I really enjoyed what I think I enjoyed most about it was the bits where he was deciding what stories to tell them, when he was sort of thinking, if I tell them this, then I'm going to have to explain that. That was probably the bit that I enjoyed the most. Yeah. It's quite wicked. I'm asking you this yet again for more book suggestions,
sure.
But science fiction does seem to go allegorical.
Yeah.
Possibly because we can't imagine a world without what we know now.
Yeah.
That's the hardest thing, is to try and get to a world that's completely imaginary. Is there a way that science fiction can escape this kind of moral, and I think you've given a couple of examples. Yeah.
The moralizing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to think about it a bit more to try and think of some which don't. Another one that I'll just throw out there is Gene Wolfe's Book of the Long Sun, which is a really, really, people describe it as the Citizen Kane of science fiction. It's a series of books, and it actually starts out feeling like a fantasy, and then eventually you figure out it's actually set in the very, very remote, distant future. And it's, that's not a moralizing story, I think. I have to admit I'm not really sure what it's about. I just know that it's a great series of science fiction novels. It is very opaque and confusing and quite literary. I mean, the language he uses is amazing. If he wasn't a science fiction writer, I think he'd be much more famous.
Because the reason that I'm asking this is that the reason that I got everyone together to talk about this book was that I saw a sign at a protest that said something like, make Margaret Atwood fiction again. And I was thinking that the obvious book is Handmaid's Tale. But with this one, it seems like this fear has almost diminished slightly, what I mean? Yeah. And that is kind of terrifying in itself, in a way. Yeah. It feels like whack-a-mole at the moment, don't bomb here, do this. Blah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just, do you think that it has dated to a point that it isn't of relevance now, or do you think that it has some relevance now, or?
I don't know. At this point, I don't think that it's that relevant, just because the technology is so much more challenging than people thought it was going to be in the early 2000s, that even changing quite simple organisms like, in some ways, genetically engineered organisms are ubiquitous, like knockout mice, for example, which are mice which have had specific genes knocked out so you can test them. And they're just in every lab and every research facility or university or whatever. The kind of technologies that she's talking about here, in which you can kind of genetically engineer a new race of humans which are vegetarian. I mean, humans are hard to work with, not only for obviously ethical reasons, but because gestation times are long. When you're working with yeast or Drosophila, which are the fruit flies that people do genetic experiments on, or mice, you can kind of you can sort of get results and do tests and that, but with humans they're hard to work with. It takes a long time to grow them, and obviously you do have these impossible ethical concerns with genetically modifying humans. So yeah, I feel like this stuff is just like this kind of stuff is just such a long way away in the mm-hmm. future that it's really not something that.
Because the thing that occurs to me, like even those massive fires that are at the start where they're burning right. off the animals and stuff like yeah. that, like that's yeah. one of my earliest memories is when there was right. a foot and mouth outbreak in England, I think it was.
Oh, right.
And I remember seeing on the news these big right. piles of animals being burned. And I just feel like a lot of what it does is tells us maybe where we were in 2003, you know what I mean? Like in a lot of ways it kind of feels like, you know, and it kind of gives credence to this thing that you're saying, that we feel like we know what's going to end us, but maybe we don't have a bloody clue what's going to end us.
It's a funny thing because we are seeing, because she's talking about the destruction of the environment through genetic technologies, and that's something that's not happening, but we are living through just the mass extinction of many species. And if you want to read not a science fiction book, but just a science book that is really terrifying, Elizabeth Kolbert's book, The Sixth Extinction, which won the Pulitzer Prize in, I think, 2015, is really, really horrific. And it's basically just talking about that, the mass extinction of the Anthropocene. And that's through, you know, emergent diseases that are, or invasive species that can move into new ecospheres because the climate is changing and that kind of thing. So in a way we are seeing the kind of wholesale environmental destruction that Atwood wrote about, but it's not happening because of, you know, scientists. It's happening because of industrialism.
Because that is the thing, that is something that I think that sign made me think about, is that you know, if you want to put the phantods up here, it's probably a lot better to actually read some complex, you know, because I think that's the thing is that fiction, I don't know if this is true, and it's probably a rank thing to say, it's probably a rude thing to say, but you know, authors often don't have, you know, deep enough understanding of the science. I mean, do you think an author can get deep enough of understanding without, like, doing a degree in, you know, I don't know.
So we talked a bit about hard science fiction a bit earlier, and some of them, like, Neal Stephenson is a guy who writes hard science fiction, and he definitely gets deep enough in to be able to really make you understand. If you read his book Seven Eves, you'll understand more about, you know, like orbital mechanics and space station construction than any reasonable person could ever want to know in their lifetime, I think.
It's really interesting. I went and saw Neal Stephenson when he was here. Right, someone brought him over for a I think it was like a gaming conference or something. And one of the things he said, which was so, like, it really kind of blew my mind, was that he's not really interested in writing apocalyptic literature. Like, he's really, because he feels like all you do then is just take shit away. Like, you just go, here is a city. It has no buildings now and no people, you know. And so it's not a creative act. So he was talking about this idea of, you know, sort of the creative, the anti-apocalyptic novel, which I thought was a really interesting idea. And I think does come through in his work in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Although I would say the least interesting part of Seven Eves for me was the post, was the sort of the new society that he talks about in the post-apocalyptic. So,
he really does like the new society. I was just thinking about the one before the, and that I can never pronounce the name.
Anathem.
Like I find him quite interesting on that sociological kind of bent as well. Because I think, you see, this is the other thing that I think about Oryx and Crake. You know, I was thinking while I was reading it, is it's almost like a Cliff Notes in some ways. You know, like if you know, like dealing with Seven Eves or dealing with you know, those big hard science fiction books, maybe this is a way of getting a taste for it, or getting you know, an understanding. I don't know.
One of the more interesting post-apocalypse books I read recently was Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, which is a different kind of, almost a different kind of genre, and it's something that I call the pastoral post-apocalypse, which is where you kind of get rid of modern technological society and have quite a nice society after that. And they, you know, like the actors and musicians, and they kind of travel around and they grow, you know, they grow their own food, and it's all just very, very nice. And I think that's again a kind of funny reaction. the books by, what's that guy's name? The Passage and the Twelve.
Oh,
Cronin, yeah, his last book in that series, which is actually a pretty terrible book. But an awful lot of that is like that. It's the post-apocalyptic society, and it's kind of back to nature, and they're living on the farm, and, you know, no one has to kind of, you know, like, sit in traffic in the morning or anything like that. Yeah, so it's, yeah, often these things can be kind of a fantasy about, a simpler society.
I totally agree. We often joke about that at home about it, because I always think it stems for me from that. Who said that? It's a bush. One of the bushes said it. We're going to bomb them back to the Stone Age or something like that. And I remember thinking, might not be a bad thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like, wouldn't that be dreadful?
Yeah.
You know, if we got rid of all technology. And, and you know, I mean, I guess in a way... you know, and this, you know, there is no fun for snowman being in a pre-technological world, you know, like it's just, I mean, I thought one of the things that was really, that, you know, the dependent, you know, the absolute horror of the injury, you know, like I just, I always enjoy a book that has a horror of like the cut toe or the, you know, like I thought that was really well managed in there. I really thought it was great.
Yeah, Stephen King does that in The Stand, which I think is, that's the, we should throw that in there, because I think that's the best post-apocalyptic novel. If you're going to read any of the books that we talk about in here, that's the one to go for. But yeah, the childbirth, you know, in the post-apocalypse, cutting your leg in the post-apocalypse, and he makes it very, very real, as he's very good at doing, the horror of... just the ordinary horror of what that involves.
Because it's just that weird thing, eh? Like, this expectancy we have that we will live.
Yep.
You know, like, I always find that really odd.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
that we've kind of... I remember thinking that after reading... I used to work at the medical library, and, you know, like, there was a book that used to come in that was just called... what was it called? It was all about, like tapeworm.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it was all those
right.
kind of animals
yep.
that like to live on us.
Yeah.
And I just remember reading that and thinking, really, the miracle isn't that things go wrong. The miracle is that things go right.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like that. And this expectancy we have to live, you know, like, God, it's getting bigger and bigger now.
Yeah.
You know, it's really weird. Oh, that was depressing.
Yeah. So let's try and say, well, it's hard to be upbeat in post-apocalyptic literary criticism.
Yeah, it's got to be good for you.
Yeah. What else have we got in there?
I'm just looking.
So I should ask a question of you. Have you read the other two books
no.
in the series? Oh, okay.
I feel like a failure, and I feel really bad about even just talking about this, but I am talking later with someone who's read all three, and actually I think two people that have read all three, and maintain that this is probably the best one of the three.
Okay.
Someone I spoke to said, no, I shouldn't even say that, but you know, that there's a suggestion that it kind of goes off the rails a little bit towards the end. Because it was huge when it came out, wasn't
was
it?
I think so. Okay.
I feel like everyone I knew was reading it.
Okay.
You know, like it just really
well,
felt like it captured a moment.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
like,
it was, it was very much of its time. It was very relevant. Yeah.
It was really, really great. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else. Let me think. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I'm just trying to think as well. I don't think so. I think I should be free to go.
Yes, I think you should be free to go.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
that was really interesting, and I really appreciate all your... I'm going to put together a little bibliography, because now I just want to go home and read.
Because I think we talked about like 30 books in that section. Yeah.
I think that's got to be a good thing, because I think... I don't know, like, I that's one of my pleasures of talking to you anytime, whether we're just having coffee or doing this. I always go away with a great reading list.
Yeah.
So I'll put together a reading list of those. It'll be really good.
Yeah.
And, are you looking forward to the new Blade Runner movie?
I don't know, not really.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways I like that first movie more than... Dick's book is quite hard to read after you've... because it's so different. Mm. And and I think it is one of his best books, but it's so very different from the movie that it's quite hard to enjoy. He has this great... Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep has the concept of kibble, which is this cross between kind of, I don't know, pollution and entropy, in which people's lives just fill up with... people's houses just fill up with discarded receipts and broken pens and torn paper clips, and it's just an endemic problem in the reality that he's describing. If you go away and leave your house for too long and come back, it's just filled with that kind of valueless debris, which is such a great idea. And I don't even really know what it has to do with the rest of this book, his book, but it's probably worth reading the book just alone for that. But there are maybe 20 weird, interesting ideas in that book like that. You know, Mercerism, the religion that everyone in his world that he's describing is following, which is what a lot of the book is about.
I think that they, like, they almost work, you almost want to pretend that they're one isn't based on the other, right? Runner is just so so beautiful, and I dread to think what's going to happen next.
It's an interesting adaptation because the replicants in Blade Runner are the opposite of the ones in Dick's book. They are kind of, I mean, there's a way to watch Blade Runner and see them as freed slaves, and he's kind of the guy that's tracking them down and executing them, and so he's certainly the villain in that, if you see it that way. And so, you know, they have empathy, they care for each other, whereas in Dick's book, because he's religious, they don't have empathy, so they're horrifying. I guess you could say they're philosophical zombies. They act exactly like humans, but they have no sentience. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Maybe we should do it. We should do another one on that. We could go and see Blade Runner together, and then it'd be wicked. Okay, thank you very much, Dan.
Thanks, Beth.